From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 30 years ago, writer Erica Jong turned American publishing and the nation on their backsides with her 1973 novel, Fear of Flying, the uninhibited adventures of 29-year-old Isadora Wing and her readiness to fly in the face of 1970s nice women don't say that conventions, became a blockbuster bestseller and a cultural phenomenon. Growing up female in America, what a liability, observed Isadora. Fear of Flying became a popular touchstone for a generation of repressed good girls ready to push for what they wanted in the workplace, in relationships, in bed. Fast forward 3 decades, at the checkout counter, it's hard to find a magazine cover without a scantily clad woman in come-hither headlines like Finding the X-Spot. On cable, those voracious Sex and the City gals are looking for love in 5-inch stilettos, but there's also a remake in the works of The Stepford Wives. The Betty Friedan generation of the 70s has grown into the Botox generation. In a recent New York Times column, Maureen Dowd observes, there's even a retro trend among women toward deserting the fast track for a pleasant life of sitting around Starbucks, gabbing with their girlfriends' baby strollers beside them, logging time at the gym to firm up for the He-Man CEO at home. What would Fear of Flying's Isadora Wing make of all this? We asked the woman who started it all. Tonight on Point, Erica Jong and the shape of women, men, sex, and feminism 30 years on. Did you fly 30 years ago with Erica Jong? Did you gasp? Were you shocked? Was Fear of Flying a revelation? And are relations between men and women better today than they were in 1973? Better in general? Better between the sheets? Or not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from New York is Erica Jong, best-selling writer and author of the landmark novel Fear of Flying, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. She is author of 8 novels, 6 collections of poetry, and several works of nonfiction. Her latest novel is Sappho's Leap. Good evening and welcome, Erica Jong.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us in the studio tonight is On Point's news analyst Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University and author of Interracial Intimacy, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. Good evening and welcome, Randall Kennedy.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. Erica Jong, I loved coming back to this after so many years. I was amazed at how fresh it seemed 30 years on. And I was really struck by the story you tell in the new afterword to your book in the kind of 30th anniversary edition, of the young Erica Jong who was looking for her way in the world and who came upon Fear of Flying as a huge breakout opener, but it wasn't your first novel, and you were kind of surprised yourself at how it emerged. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. I don't think anybody can anticipate waking up one morning and being a cultural icon, whatever that is.
Right.
You
Whoops,
know, certainly
what did I do?
Not. What is that? Certainly not a writer, because it's the nature of a writer to have lots of self-doubt. You know, we do our work alone in our pajamas. Mm-hmm. We're very isolated. We're very solitary. Half the time, we don't know what we're producing. And so it was quite amazing to discover that all these fantasies and fears that I thought were so unique to me belonged to millions and millions and millions of women. And then I had the sort of incredible experience of going all over the world and having women who spoke Chinese or Serbo-Croat or Czech or Macedonian say to me that they were Isadora Wing too. So it was quite a trip, quite a ride, and certainly nothing prepared me for that.
You know, reading it again this week, I was struck at how, I mean, you know endlessly the whole buzz around Fear of Flying is sex, 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 sex. But it's so much more than sex. It really is this young woman's, search for herself.
It's what we call a Bildungsroman.
There you go, a Bildungsroman.
A novel of a young person growing up.
Absolutely. Sex riven right through it.
And looking for identity.
Yeah.
Yes.
But why has it... Why is sex the big signboard that hangs around Fear of Flying? Was it because it was so unusual for a woman at that time to step up and put all these things down so explicitly in black and white?
It was the rap that Fear of Flying got. I mean, male critics read it and they were horrified. You know, Paul Theroux said that Isadora Wing was a mammoth pudenda.
Right. Watch out.
Actually, it should be pudendum. But anyway, they were outraged.
That she could be so on fire with this lusty sensuality and so candid about her desire.
Well, that she could be so open about her fantasy life. That, I think, frightened people. And that she could admit to sitting at a table in her seminar room at Columbia and imagining the men around the table and thinking which organs of hers they made to palpitate, as she says somewhere. I mean, she was so aware of herself as a sexual being. And I think that was more frightening even than the sex, because the sex in Fear of Flying is largely very disappointing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
As sex often is in real life.
To Isadora, doesn't live up to what she's looking for.
Her fantasies are fabulous. Fabulous. You know, she has this fantasy of the zipless,
you
whatever.
Know, the zipless F-word, we can't say it too bad, but
radio.
It is an icon itself, and she never quite finds it.
And she never finds it, and she says it's a platonic ideal, and when you find it, zippers fall away like rose petals. And so her fantasy life is extremely rich, but she meets this really handsome guy, this Langian analyst, and he turns out to be impotent. Her husband is potent, but totally unimaginative. Yeah. So in that way, he disappoints her. So really, it's an epic of stumblings and disappointments, like life.
Yes, exactly like life.
And
not every man was disappointed, Erica Jong. Henry Miller, of course, as you know, loved it. In the New York Times, he compared it to his own Tropic of Cancer. He predicted that, quote, "This book will make literary history. Because of it, women are going to find their own voice and give us great sagas of sex, life, joy, and adventure." Did Fear of Flying deliver all of that, Erica Jong?
Well, I think it had an enormous impact on how books were written, and not only by women writers. I mean, it did open a door, but also by men writers. I don't think you can imagine the novels of John Irving, let's say, mm-hmm. without Fear of Flying. I think that men writers also began to look more intimately at women's feelings because of the outpouring of books by women in the 70s. And this was one that unlocked a door that had been slammed shut for a long time. We tend to forget how recent freedom to publish is. It wasn't until 1962 that Tropic of Cancer was published in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, it was banned, and it was published only in Paris and smuggled in these little green Olympia Press editions. And if you own one of them, you own a valuable collector's item. But it was 62 that Tropic of Cancer came to America. And it was 67 that John Updike published Couples, which was the first mainstream novel that really dealt with wife swapping in the suburbs
mm-hmm.
and dealt explicitly with sex. The reason that book came in 67 is that before then it wasn't possible to publish such a book. Also, 69, Portnoy's Complaint. Before that, if you remember, the novels all had asterisks whenever there was going to be a sex scene. So we had this window of opportunity, let's say, when suddenly, legally, one had the right to publish. And writers were besotted with this freedom. And suddenly they thought, oh my God, I don't have to put in the asterisks. I can really write about what goes on
but for all
between
that,
men and women.
They could, but for all that, you were very brave and very early in stepping up to bat on that front. Give us a sense of yourself in those years leading up to 1973 when you wrote this breakthrough, Fear of Flying, Erica Jong. Who were you? What were you doing?
I was a graduate student at Columbia in 18th century English literature. I was a compulsive A student, a Woodrow Wilson fellow. I was forever winning fellowships because I was really very good at this academic bull.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a Barnard graduate. And I was busy. I had published two slim volumes of verse, and I fully expected to be a professor of English and to continue to publish little volumes of verse that would win prizes and would never make enough money for me to live on.
You had a failed early marriage. Your poetry had a very strong feminist streak to it. And a publisher editor said to you, after you gave them a novel that was kind of in a man's voice, said, no, bring this feminine voice, this woman's voice to a novel. That's what we want.
He said, bring the voice of your poems into a novel. And it was actually the right thing to say at the right time because it really liberated me. It really did. And it was sort of the kick in the pants I needed to dare to write Fear of Flying. And Fear of Flying was a terrifying book to write. I wrote it with my heart pounding, believing no one would ever publish it, but really wanting to get it out, even if it meant committing it to a desk drawer. I hated those people who every Sunday read the Times Book Review and gnash their teeth.
Why haven't
and say,
I done that?
Why haven't I done that? And I went to school with this person, and he was such a nerd. And look, he's written a book, and I haven't. I didn't want to be that sort of person who's always bitter. And so I thought, okay, you know, before I get my PhD, I will try my hand at something that really unlocks the inside of a woman's brain. And I did. And because it was 1972, I guess, when I turned it into my publisher, and because for the first time there were women out there who could read books and who were powerful editors, it had a huge response. And the first time we knew that something funny was happening with this book was when the galley proofs started being stolen in the publishing house. That's always a good sign.
Yeah, they just had to get it out of there, kind of a black market for Erica Jong and Fear of Flying early on. Erica, stand by. I want to get our Randall Kennedy into this conversation. Randall, you read it before. You've just been through it again. What does Fear of Flying, not in 1973 or 83 or 93, but in 2003, bring to mind for you?
Well, I'll get to your question, but let me just note that this book had a big influence not just on women. I remember I was graduating from high school the year that Fear of Flying came out, and I read it then, and I read it more recently, and it's great being on the line with Erica Jong. To get to your question more directly, the thing that strikes me is that the domestication of the erotic in literature. I mean, now you go to a bookstore and there are shelves and shelves and shelves, if not whole sectors in the bookstore devoted to erotica, neurotica, erotic stories by Jewish writers, erotica.
I'm in that book.
You are indeed. Erotic noir, erotica by black writers. I mean, there's been this.
Susie Bright's anthology.
Every year. The best
the
erotic in erotic
anthology.
Writing by women, the best of erotic. So the erotic has just emerged.
We're not shocked. We're saturated.
Well, we are saturated, and that raises a question. In certain ways, this is obviously good, but is there a bad side?
It's still
to this?
Very hard to write a good sex scene.
No,
it doesn't matter. And you know what's very interesting to
yes.
me? You know, when I go to colleges and I talk to the students who study Fear of Flying in their American Lit courses or their Human Sexuality courses or American Studies or because it's taught all over the place, I say, what do you identify with about this 30-year-old book?
Mm-hmm.
And they say the double standard is alive and well. A woman who is upfront about her sexuality is still considered a slut. And this is despite the fact that you walk into any book stand in an airport and you see a million such books, erotic books, pornographic mm-hmm. books. This is despite the fact that every newsstand has glossy magazines that say 101 ways to drive him wild in bed.
Right now.
Learn what your man really wants.
Right.
It seems like it's everywhere, and yet the college women tell me that the double standard is alive and well. That's pretty interesting.
It is indeed. Erica Jong, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We are talking tonight with Erica Jong on Fear of Flying, Feminism, and American Sexuality 30 Years On. Listeners, we want you to step up tonight. Be as brave as Erica Jong and Isadora Wing. Is sex better today than in 1973 or not? Why? Where is Isadora Wing today? What's she up to? Are women better off today than in 1973? Are men better than they were in 1973? Join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What was your reaction when you first read Fear of Flying? Did you gasp? Would you gasp today? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Erica Jong on Fear of Flying, Feminism, and American Sexuality. 30 years on, Fear of Flying came out in 1973. You can join the conversation tonight. Who is today's Isadora Wing, the new sexual soul searcher, the fearless feminist seeker? And did you fly 30 years ago with Erica Jong in Fear of Flying? Was it a shock? Was it a revelation? I guess more than that, where have women, feminism, and female sexuality come to 30 years on? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Erica Jong, you were giving us just a little taste earlier of the... There's so much in this book that we cannot say. It's interesting to me. You know, in The New Yorker, all over in print now, even in esteemed print, you've got all kinds of profanity. On the air, we still have a more Victorian standard. But the zipless F-word, which you made a kind of an icon, is right out there. You describe it. You began to read earlier. It was a platonic ideal, zipless, because when you came together, zippers fell away like rose petals. Underwear blew off in one breath like dandelion fluff. Tongues intertwined and turned liquid. Your whole soul flowed out through your tongue and into the mouth of your lover. You were right into it. You've got a bit of a reading there. We'd love to get some flavor of Fear of Flying.
I just want to warn you, you know, we're in John Ashcroft's America where liberty... is clothed.
Even in the lobby of the Justice Department.
Right. Liberty is clothed.
Well, here in our in our lobby, Erica Jong, Lady Liberty is breasts to the wind.
Okay.
So have at it.
You know, I say, we'll probably never see each other again. Maybe that's why we're doing this, he says. We make our way out of the palace and into another courtyard, which is now chiefly used as a parking lot. Amid the ghosts of Opels and Volkswagens and Peugeots, we embrace, mouth to mouth and belly to belly. Adrian must have the wettest kiss in history. His tongue is everywhere, like the ocean. We are sailing away. His penis, bulging under his corduroy pants, is the tall red smokestack of an ocean liner. And I am moaning around it like the ocean wind. And I am saying all the silly things you say while necking in parking lots, trying somehow to express a longing which is inexpressible, except maybe in poetry. And it all comes out so lame. I love your mouth. I love your hair. I love your ears. I want you. I want you. I want you. Anything to avoid saying I love you, because this is almost too good to be love. Too yummy and delicious to be anything as serious and sober as love. Your whole mouth has turned liquid. His tongue tastes better than a nipple to an infant. And don't throw me any psychiatric interpretations, Bennett, because I'll throw them right back at you. Infantile, regressed, basically incestuous, no doubt. But I'd give my life just to go on kissing him like that. And how are you going to analyze this? Meanwhile, he's got my ass and is cupping it with both hands. He's put my book on the fender of a Volkswagen, and he's grabbed my ass instead. Isn't that why I write? To be loved? I don't know anymore. I don't even know my own name.
This Erica Jong, reading from Fear of Flying, 1973, letting her freak flag fly 30 years ago. And it still turns our head today, those tall red smokestacks and all the rest. Erica Jong, we want to keep our callers plugged into this conversation tonight. I want to bring them in early. Ellen's calling from Bedford, New Hampshire. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
It's wonderful to speak with Erica Jong, the woman who liberated me 30 years ago.
How did she do it, Ellen?
I read her book. I'm 63 now.
And was it good for you?
Oh, excellent, excellent. And I would never have read anything like that if it hadn't been literary.
Can you remember why you picked it up? Was it word of mouth?
Amen.
No, I think all my friends were reading it.
And what difference did it make to you, Ellen? Sorry, Erica.
Oh, go ahead.
Ellen, what difference did it make to you? How did it liberate you? Ah, we may have lost Ellen there.
Oh, dear.
No. Yeah, I think she's gone. But Erica, you've got the point, and she makes a good one that this, I mean, well, a whole lot of things there. Whatever its kind of iconic reputation is, this was literature. This was Erica Jong's literature. This was right in the Philip Roth vein. And B, you've got Ellen and an awful lot of other women and probably some men as well who felt, hey, this is a new horizon I can shoot for.
Well, it's very nice to have your feelings affirmed and to be and to know that you're not crazy. And that's how a lot of readers felt. I mean, I think a lot of women readers felt, oh, my God, I'm not crazy. Other people have those fantasies, too. That's a very affirming thing. And for men, well, I'll tell you what one man told me at a dinner party in New York.
Yeah.
Whenever I saw that book on a woman's night table, I knew I was going to get lucky.
Because Erica Jong had had popped the top on that, had cleared the way.
So they say. I have seemed to have enhanced people's sex lives, and I mean, I think that's really karmic goodness there. I mean, I'll certainly go to heaven for that.
Mary Beth is calling from Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Hi, Mary Beth. You're on the air.
Hi, Playboy capital of the world, by the way, but. I read the book at the request of a staff psychiatrist, male, and he thought when I thought it was sort of approved, and in reality, I can sex life very private.
Well, Mary
fabulous.
Beth, I'm sorry, but your cell phone is breaking up so badly that I think you're driving out of range there. My producer is saying that Mary Beth called to say that she heard about the book from her psychiatrist. And that she found, you know, when she opened up with other women as a result of reading the book, she was confirmed. Erica Jong.
A lot of psychiatrists recommended the book because they felt that their patients were not able to access their dreams and their fantasies, and that the book made it possible for them to do it. I've heard that from many, many psychiatrists and social workers and other healthcare people. So I guess that's a good thing. I mean, I honestly think that anything that opens you up in your mental life, in your imagination, is great, is inspiring. And certainly Fear of Flying did that for many people.
Randall Kennedy, come in here with us.
I'd like to know if Erica Jong has gotten criticism from other women writers, women intellectuals. I'm thinking here in particular of a teacher that I had in law school, Catherine McKinnon, but other people from other intellectual vantages as well.
Have you gotten Andrea Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon critique of pornography and its oppression of women therein?
Well, there's that angle, and then I guess from another angle, Phyllis Schlafly and others. So
I've had nonstop criticism in my writing career.
Uh-huh.
And probably the thing that I'm most proud of is that I've had the tenacity to persevere. And sometimes what happens is that the same people who criticized you most grovel after a number of years. I mean, you can't be a provocative writer and not get criticism. And I've gotten tons of it from women critics, from men critics, from all kinds of people who were threatened, from people who felt that they didn't have the kind of lives they wanted, and therefore they wanted to attack me for letting fresh air into their lives. You know, the criticism has been relentless ever since I started to publish. But, you know, Norman Mailer says somewhere that unless a book makes us angry or has the potential to make us angry, it's not much of a book. And I do agree with him. I mean, I think that part of the job of literature is to provoke and to make people think and
Randall.
To make them change their opinions.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there have been criticisms that have been well taken of your book? I mean, no book's absolutely perfect. Usually, after you've written something, I would assume that if you could, you might want to change it. Is there something that...
I love good criticism. And in fact, mm-hmm. I'm very grateful to a good editor who makes me look good on the page and who helps me edit out my cliches and my run-on sentences and all of that. But unfortunately, the level of criticism in this country, in book chat land, is not really about what you've written. It's more people sounding off and writing little essays on what they would have written if they were you. And that's not very helpful, I will say. You know, real criticism is enormously helpful. And we all know what that is. And if we're lucky, we get it from our beloved editors. Every author is grateful for that. But when somebody writes a book review years after you've finished the book and basically attacks you as for being immoral, a slut, a filthy-minded Jewess, which is the kind of really irresponsible stuff I've gotten.
Even years later?
How can you take it? Yeah, how can you take it seriously? And then the other people who write you these unsigned letters in crabbed, crazy handwriting that say things like, Hitler should have finished all of you.
I'm not talking about
that
those
stuff seriously.
One shouldn't, but I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about smart, intelligent people who are reading your book after it's published. My question is, are there any criticisms that have been published that you think, upon consideration, are well taken?
Erica Jong.
Yeah, of course, I've seen things that I've thought about, and look, I've written 22 books.
Right, so it's not the last one.
So I've absorbed. I've absorbed them and I've tried to utilize them.
Can I put an edge on that, maybe, Erica? You know, in the sort of line of criticism of pornography that Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon have taken.
Andrea Dworkin happens to be a friend of mine. I've written about her work, which I think is outstanding and provocative and important.
So did Fear of Flying fall within her target or not? Is she saying, no, this is something else?
No, she didn't.
This is not exploitation. This is exploration.
But this is really comparing apples and oranges because both Andrea and Catherine MacKinnon write nonfiction about, and Catherine MacKinnon writes about legal issues and the law. And she is, in fact, a professor of law, as you said earlier.
Right.
And you cannot compare legal writing to fiction, which is, after all, about the fantasy lives of people and is about our mythic ideas of women. You can't compare the two. You know, Catherine MacKinnon has drafted laws which she thinks will be helpful to keep women from being abused.
Mm-hmm.
We can discuss that and whether they are really prophylactic and whether they will help deter violence against women. But you can't compare a novel to legal writing.
Erica Jong, let's take another tack here. I wonder what you think of the direction that female sexuality has taken in the decades since 1973. I mean, you were encouraging a kind of candor here at the very least.
Right.
I don't know if you would, if looking back, you'd describe yourself as encouraging license or not free, sexual freedom or not?
Certainly candor. Sexual freedom in the sense of mad promiscuity, that hasn't worked for me, and it doesn't work for most women. You know, everybody goes through stages in their lives. Usually it's hopeful that you go through them when you're young.
But what do you think of the direction
when
the culture,
you're not married?
But how about the direction that culture has taken in general around female sexuality? Positive, negative, what you expected or not?
I think what the culture has done around female sexuality is deeply, deeply disappointing. I mean, I look at Sex in the City, and there's a show that wouldn't exist without Fear of Flying.
Mm-hmm.
And are those four characters happier than women were in the 70s or the 80s or the 50s? Not at all. You know, they wear 5-inch heels. They wear very revealing clothing. And yet they're all disappointed with the men in their lives. They're not satisfied. They can't find a significant connection. And then when I look at young teenagers today, young women in high school, they're all going out and servicing men with blowjobs, but not deriving much pleasure themselves. They're servicing men because it gives them a great sense of power to service men and because it makes them popular. But is that about women enjoying their bodies? Not at all.
So that it's big, free, fulfilled woman has not emerged?
Not at all. Not at all.
Why
and
not?
In fact,
why not? Is it men that are oppressive? Is it somehow women's own internalized constraint? How do you interpret it?
Partly it's internalized constraint, and partly people are scared to death of pleasure and happiness in their lives. And the number of people who are open to their own sexuality is small. And the number of people who are not guilt-ridden, because we live in this really baleful Judeo-Christian culture where we're told from the time we're little kids that sex is bad and you know, that it will grow hair on the palms of your hands or the equivalent. One of the reasons that I wrote my new novel, Sappho's Leap, was to go back to a pagan time before Judeo-Christian culture had sort of blackened the skies of sexuality. Mm. And really, when people really worshipped Aphrodite and worshipped pleasure, I was interested in that because I was trying to imagine a world before morality, a Judeo-Christian morality and guilt before Eve was responsible for all our sorrows.
But you had to go back thousands of years to find
that,
not forward
Sappho.
30 years.
Right. I had to go back to Sappho, as I did in my last novel, in order to find that. And I was really interested in knowing, was there a culture in which pleasure was approved rather than disapproved?
And you found it.
And I found it in ancient Greece. Mm.
Ellen's calling from Middleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, Eric. It's wonderful to get to talk to you after all these years. I agree with you with so much that you're saying. It's wonderful, but I'm shocked to hear that younger women are not enjoying their sexuality. But my question was, or my statement was, that women in their 50s and 60s still need to be sensual and in touch with their own sexuality. And I wonder how that can ever happen to us if younger women, like you say on Sex and the City, aren't allowed and given permission to do that.
Ooh, Ellen, it's great. Thanks for your call, Erica Jong.
We can give ourselves permission. And paradoxically, I think that older women are more liberated sexually than younger women, much more liberated. In fact, I would go so far as to say that the great new trend of the next several decades is going to be senior sex. You heard it here. But what I'm saying, I mean, I did an Oprah show about a year ago with my daughter, and the whole gist of the show was young women, preteens and teenagers in high school, servicing men and not experiencing orgasm themselves. And it was quite astonishing. I mean, Oprah, who is on the cutting edge of so many trends, you know, revealed this. She had many young women on who discussed it. My daughter, who's 24, Molly Jong Fast, confirmed it from her own experience.
We've talked about it on this show. What a bitter irony decades after Fear of Flying Randall Kennedy.
Well, I must say I'm a bit confused now, because a little while ago we were talking about fear of flying and it opening doors and making cultural space for things which had previously been suppressed and
taboo.
Marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm hearing more recently that nothing has changed.
Or things have regressed.
Or that there has been retrogression. Don't fit together very well.
There was a very brief period of tremendous openness and freedom. And then repression came in again. I mean, you have to look at this in line with the political things.
Erica Jong, hold that thought if you would. It's so great to have you. We have to take a short break here.
Okay.
We'll be right back with Erica Jong. It's the 30th anniversary of Fear of Flying. Where have women, feminism, female sexuality come to 30 years on? And are relations between men and women better today than in 1973? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Erica Jong on Fear of Flying, Feminism and American Sexuality 30 years on from the 1973 publication of the book that went on to sell 7 million plus copies around the world. You can join the conversation. Where is that free-spirited Isadore Wing in today's America? What's she up to? Are women better off today than in 1973 or not? And are we freer to talk about it all today, about sex, about self, about men and women? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with Erica Jong. Kate's calling from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I feel like I'm one of the lucky ones whose mother read Erica back in the 70s as I was going through puberty. And my mother was open enough to discuss Erica's thoughts with me. And discuss what I was about to go into as I was entering college and that whole exploration stage and the double standard of it was okay for the guys to have the one night stand, but supposedly not for the women.
Right.
But it was okay for me to feel what I was feeling and to not necessarily have to be the good girl.
And so did it work out for you, that message, Kate?
Well, I think so, in that I think that I've been able to maintain fairly healthy sexual relationships since then and be able to be honest about my needs and my wants and not just pleasing the guy. And it's so sad to hear that now still the girls going into college or exploring sexuality still have that emphasis on pleasing the guys and not recognizing that it's okay to want what they want.
Erica Jong, your book was Mother's Milk to Kate.
That is so wonderful to hear. And I'm glad that your mother was open about sexuality with you. And if my book had some small part in that, I'm grateful.
So let's talk about the question we raised before the break of how this got, if it's been turned around, if it's not working as well for the next generation of young American women, why not, Erica Jong? Is that about sexually transmitted disease? Is it about John Ashcroft? It surely predates that. How do you interpret it?
Well, we had a brief window of freedom. I mean, the 60s really began in 1968 or 69 and went on through the 70s until about 1978, 79. When 78, 79 came, you started to see these articles. Is feminism dead? Mm-hmm. Has feminism peaked? Is sexuality over? People couldn't wait to say that the revolution was over. And the idea that women were rising up and demanding their own pleasure was very scary to a lot of people.
And then AIDS blew into town.
If AIDS hadn't existed, it would have had to have been invented. It was so perfect. In fact, there are certain radical writers who believe that AIDS was invented in a lab. But I won't go into that because so many people have suffered and died from AIDS. Mm. That it's insulting to talk about it one way or the other. But really, the window was very narrow. And then again, you know, the crazy Christers and the fundamentalists, you know, including our present president, a word I use in inverted commas, wanted to take the world back to, you know, fundamentalist Christianity.
So how do you interpret that? I mean, you told us you had to go back thousands of years to find that sexually free society. Is sexual freedom self-limiting in human society?
Think it is, actually. I think it is self-limiting because there is no society, and this includes ancient Greece, Sappho's world, where bisexuality was quite unremarkable, and yet the laws of marriage were very particular and very strict. I think that it is self-limiting, and I think that human beings need rules and want to be in some way confined and suppressed. And actually, Sappho's Leap is in part an exploration of that, an exploration of sexual politics mm-hmm. and the way people want to restrain themselves and live in a society that has predictability and rules. I mean, you know that if you go back to the Soviet Union in the early days, right after the revolution, there was complete openness and free love. You didn't have to mm-hmm. be married to have babies. The Soviets soon found out that that didn't work.
It was part of the socialist ideal, and it didn't last.
That free love was part of the socialist mm-hmm. ideal, and it didn't work. And society after society has discovered that. I think the trickiest thing is to have a society that has enough rules so that it can have shape and form and yet not repress the individual and the individual's differentness from other groups. I think that the secret of our civilization is how we treat the individual. Do we allow, even if we are not homosexuals, do we allow homosexuals to have complete civil rights equal to heterosexuals? Mm-hmm. That's a sign of civilization, when we can do that. Not because we are that ourselves, but because we believe in the right of the individual to express herself or himself. And I think we're still quite far from that in America. You know, as a country that was founded in the Enlightenment, on Enlightenment ideals, we have these wonderful ideals of liberty. Do we live up to them? Most of the time we don't.
Randall Kennedy.
But there are ideals.
Yeah. Randall, Erica Jong describes by her own estimation, fear of flying as having been launched into a fairly narrow window. I mean, the 7 million copies were va-voom, but
15 million around the world.
15 around the world. But the tide of history kind of came back in here.
Well, I think we should be we should not be unduly utopian here. Of course, there are problems around us: repression, suppression, disease, ignorance, all of the many things that cabin liberty, cabin our ability to express pleasure and to feel pleasure. But it seems to me that through the writing and proselytizing of people like Erika Jong, we are in a considerably better position than we were in 1973. I think, for instance, of the gay liberation movement, mm-hmm. of the way in which various sorts of sexuality, various sorts of intimate associations, much more available now.
They've been, to some degree, decriminalized, not throughout the entire country, not in every state, but they have been somewhat decriminalized. And the other thing that has changed as a result of the feminist movement, the second wave, is fatherhood. I think that we have a totally different view of fatherhood, and that really goes back to the second wave feminists who said it is not a shame for the father to take the child to the pediatrician. Fathers can equally parent with mothers. And I look at the whole generation of men in their 20s and 30s, and I see the delight and the joy they have in their children, and the expression of it, which my father in his generation could never express, never, because he would have been considered a sissy if he had. The tenderness of young men with their children, the parenting, they have been liberated to enjoy their children in a very different way.
That,
There have been good changes, absolutely. And a lot of them are attributable to equality between the sexes, to the fact that women can go out and work. Of course, we're still paid less, promoted less, et cetera. And men can parent. And those are all good changes.
Let's take another call. Brad's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to say my girlfriend and I have been going out for about 2 years now.
How old are you, Brad?
I'm 20 now.
Okay.
And she's a very liberal, open-minded, forward-thinking person, except I've been noticing that when we make love, it is still, even though we've discussed this, it's still focused on me, on my pleasure, and she tends to be extremely timid of her body, of exploring her pleasure and things like that, and also discussing it with me. And although, like, I'm aware of talking to friends of mine who are much older, that like 10 years ago they had even greater difficulty discussing things like this. So I see there has been some progress.
How do you interpret her attitude, Brad? What do you make of it? What does she say about it?
Well, I mean, I personally interpret it as some deep set suppression. And I don't really understand where it's originating or how to eliminate it, even though 30 years have gone by since the publication of this novel, that people have had this time to read, to think about, and to understand, and yet there still seems to be this big gap between where are these suppressions coming from?
Where are men and women? Erika Jong, what would you say to Brad?
I think it's very hard for people to approve of pleasure in themselves. And I think that, you know, you can liberate each other, you and your girlfriend. Really, you can, by giving each other safe space in which to talk about things. And really, that's what intimacy is about.
You think Brad might be able to do more to put her at ease?
To put her at ease by loving her, by telling her that it's okay to talk about things that maybe nobody's ever given her permission to talk about before. And with his own tenderness and his own passion, to be able to make her more self-approving about her body and her feelings. I mean, this could be a great challenge and adventure.
Brad, keep your love light on. Steve's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
It's
a great thrill to be speaking with Erika Jong. And I read your Fear of Flying about 20 years ago. One thought I had is that the thrill that the book gave people in the first run of the book may have diminished somewhat because it opened the floodgates in a way. And mm-hmm. by the time I had read it, there was a kind of quaintness about it almost. which was, you know, didn't diminish the excellence, you know, that it has, you know, proved to, you know, through the through time.
Though I have to say, Steve, rereading it just recently, I have to say it's in many ways it stays very fresh as well. But what do you make of the lasting impact or not?
Well, it's good reading. It's a good book. It's a good story, and it does capture a moment in time that was truly exhilarating. I'm 40, and some of the thrill of sexual liberation and so forth had probably passed slightly by the time, you know, I was in my 20s and so forth.
My producer tells me that you're a psychiatrist,
yes,
always prescribing antidepressants that diminish sexual drive.
That's my main point of calling, in fact. I think today's Isadora Wing would probably seek a psychiatrist who probably would have prescribed a drug that would alter her set point for deriving sexual pleasure.
So do you find the mean, you're calling from Madison, do you find the mean sexuality in Madison beneath where it ought to be, Steve?
There seems to be a lot of sexual repression, whether it's due to Lexapro or Prozac or Depakote. Who can tell?
I am witness to this, and it is a daily challenge to treat depression without inhibiting sexual response. And it's just a thought. There are millions of women and men, perhaps more women, on these serotonin reuptake inhibitors that more often than not do have a deleterious effect on one's own pleasure.
Steve, you're good. I'm also told, though, you've got a question about regional sexuality. What's that?
Yes, I did. I've noticed that it's slightly more difficult here than in the Northeast to elicit an honest response to my question of people who I put on these medications about, you know, how this is affecting their sex lives. And I just wanted to hear if you had an opinion about that, too.
Erica
Jones. What did they say? They say, what sex life? Is that how you know there's a problem? No, I think that, you know, there is a lot of sexual inhibition in the United States today, and I don't know how it breaks down by region, but I certainly hear a lot of married people complaining that they don't have sex very often, that they work way too hard, that they can't even make an appointment with their spouse. I read in all the popular magazines about spouses being driven to take hotel rooms in the afternoon as if they were adulterers because at home they never can get any private time together. And I think that we tend to think as a civilization that intimacy will come automatically, even if the kids are screaming and the in-laws are visiting and you're both working day and night. And I think we ought to get smart about setting up times to be with our partner in a setting where we're not constantly on call.
Erica Jung, we're out of time and we regret it. You were brave and bold 30 years ago, and you're brave and bold today. It's just great talking with you. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Randall.
Thank you.
Erica Jung, author of Fear of Flying, 30 years ago. Her latest novel is Sappho's Leap. Randall Kennedy, what do you think? There goes American sexuality.
Well, the sexual state of the union is a complex story, no doubt.
No doubt. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.